662.
Yes.
Yes. In integral knowledge, right.
Okay, can I start now? Yeah. An integral knowledge presupposes an integral reality. For it is the power of a truth consciousness which is itself the consciousness of the reality. But our idea and sense of reality vary with our status and movement of consciousness, its sight, its stress, its intake of things. That sight or stress can be intensive and exclusive or extensive, inclusive and comprehensive. It is quite possible, and it is in its own field a valid movement for our thought and for a very high line of spiritual achievement, to affirm the existence of the ineffable absolute, to emphasize its sole reality, and to negate and abolish for ourselves, to expunge from our idea and sense of reality the individual being and the cosmic creation. The reality of the individual is Brahman, the absolute. The reality of the cosmos is Brahman, the absolute. The individual is a phenomenon, a temporal appearance in the cosmos. The cosmos itself is a phenomenon, a larger and more complex temporal appearance. The two terms, knowledge and ignorance, belong only to this appearance. In order to reach an absolute superconsciousness, both have to be transcended. Ego consciousness and cosmic consciousness are extinguished in that supreme transcendence, and there remains only the absolute. For the absolute Brahman exists only in its own identity and is beyond all other knowledge. There the very idea of the knower and the known, and therefore of the knowledge in which they meet and become one, disappears, is transcended and loses its validity. So that to mind and speech, the absolute Brahman must remain always unattainable. In opposition to the view we have put forward, or in completion of it, the view of the ignorance itself as only either a limited or an involved action of the divine knowledge, limited in the partly conscient, involved in the inconscient, we might say from this other end of the scale of things, that knowledge itself is only a higher ignorance. Since it stops short of the absolute reality, which is self-evident to itself, but to mind unknowable. This absolutism corresponds to a truth of thought and to a truth of supreme experience in the spiritual consciousness. But by itself, it is not the whole of spiritual thought, complete and comprehensive, and it does not exhaust the possibilities of the supreme spiritual experience. Okay. The absolutist view of reality, consciousness, and knowledge is founded on one side of the earliest Vedantic thought, but it is not the whole of that thinking. In the Upanishads, in the inspired scripture of the most ancient Vedanta, we find the affirmation of the absolute, the experience concept of the utter and ineffable transcendence, but we find also, not in contradiction to it, but as its corollary, an affirmation of the cosmic divinity, an experience concept of the cosmic self and the becoming of Brahman in the universe. Equally, we find the affirmation of the divine reality in the individual. These two is an experience concept. It is seized upon not as an appearance, but as an actual becoming. In place of a soul supreme exclusive affirmation, negating all else than the transcendent absolute, we find a comprehensive affirmation carried to its farthest conclusion. This concept of reality and of knowledge enveloping in one view the cosmic and the absolute coincides fundamentally with our own. For it implies that the ignorance too is a half-veiled part of the knowledge and world knowledge a part of self-knowledge. The Isha Upanishad insists on the unity and reality of all the manifestations of the Absolute. It refuses to confine truth to any one aspect. Brahman is the stable and the mobile, the internal and the external. All that is near and all that is far, whether spiritually or in the extension of time and space, it is being and all becomings. The pure and silent, who is without feature or action, and the seer and thinker, who organizes the world and its objects. It is the one who becomes all that we are sensible of in the universe, the immanent and that in which he takes up his dwelling. The Upanishad affirms the perfect and the liberating knowledge to be that which excludes neither the self nor its creations. The liberated spirit sees all these as becomings of the self-existent in an internal vision and by a consciousness which perceives the universe within itself instead of looking out on it, like the limited and egoistic mind, as a thing other than itself. To live in the cosmic ignorance is a blindness. But to confine oneself in an exclusive absolutism of knowledge is also a blindness. To know Brahman as at once and together the knowledge and the ignorance, to attain to the supreme status at once by the becoming and the non-becoming, to relate together realization of the transcendent and the cosmic self, to achieve foundation in the supermundane and the self-aware manifestation in the mundane is the integral knowledge. That is the possession of immortality. It is this whole consciousness with its complete knowledge that builds the foundation of the life divine and makes it attainment possible. It follows that the absolute reality of the absolute must be not a rigid, indeterminable oneness, not an infinity vacant of all, that is not a pure self-existence attainable only by the exclusion of the many and the finite, but something which is beyond these definitions, beyond indeed any description either positive or negative. All affirmations and negations are expressive of its aspects, and it is through both a supreme affirmation and a supreme negation that we can arrive at the absolute.
So actually, we had covered both these paragraphs last time, and we had thought of moving to the next paragraph in conjunction with the last one that was read today. But in essence, just to recap, In both these paragraphs, Sri Aurobindo is trying to introduce the idea of knowledge as an integral knowledge, the knowledge of the integral being or the integral reality, as he calls it here. And so, from that point of view, he relativizes human knowledge as a knowledge which really depends upon our stress, as he says, or sight, or intake of things. And this, if you want to call it ours, or the human way of arriving at knowledge, is also not really ours. It is a conditioning by consciousness. So it is the stress of consciousness, with a capital C, that gives us or enables us to view reality in a certain way or in another way. So this relates to the levels of consciousness and the modes of consciousness through which reality is manifest. And we talked a little bit about this last time, about, for example, the creation or the manifestation with the overmind at its head as that which is a exclusive concentration, as he says, intensive and exclusive. And that the reverse direction is that which reaches from that exclusivity towards an integrality, inclusive and comprehensive. So we have these two directions, and these two directions are also directions of ascent and descent. They are directions of ascent and descent because, in a sense, in the process of coming to knowledge, integral reality is extending itself and becoming its various self-formulations. Integral reality is infinite being. And being infinite, it has infinite potential of becoming and infinite potential of knowledge, of self-knowledge. So here Sri Aurobindo is also drawing on the old Upanishadic distinction between the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. That's how the field of knowledge is divided up in the Upanishads. The unknowable is unknowable not to itself, because it is self-evident to itself. It knows itself through identity. It knows itself without content, just as a self-knowledge based on experience. It experiences itself as a or through a consciousness. So we may say self-consciousness is self-knowledge without content. But if self-consciousness starts expressing its contents, then it becomes active. And this becoming active of self-consciousness is the knowledge property of consciousness within pure existence. So as soon as that begins, there begins a process which one might say is infinite. A process that is bounded on two sides by knowledge and ignorance, as with everything else, with the dualities. Knowledge and ignorance, because self-evident identity of infinite being becomes represented or objectified to itself. And as soon as that happens, it recognizes its own infinity as a potential which is infinite, which can never be fully known in its contents. Its contents can never be exhausted. And so there is to it a darkness, one may say, the darkness of God, the darkness of God of unknowing. That's why one may say that whatever knowledge one may have is only a degree of ignorance. And whatever ignorance one may have is a degree of knowledge in that duality. Now, that darkness of God is representable in two directions: above, as the unmanifest infinite power of the spirit beyond the Satchidananda, and below, as the infinite potentiality of matter, inconscient, but evolving degrees of consciousness within itself as the manifestation of self-knowledge of the spirit. Spirit in knowing itself is not just knowing itself through some kind of mental process, but through some kind of real process. That's why Sri Aurobindo uses the term real idea for the supermind. Its self-knowledge is a self-manifestation. It is at once a knowledge and a will and a becoming. So it is these two polarities that comprise the domain of knowledge. And beyond this is the domain of that which is beyond knowledge, because it is self-evident to itself. And now, from a certain point of view, if this is understood, then a certain conclusion may arise that why should we be bound to the domain of knowledge? If the supreme is beyond that domain, we should aim for that self-evident identity, which erases all content from being or from knowledge and resides in a consciousness that is forever in possession of its own reality, but unmanifest. And this is what Sri Aurobindo is addressing over here. He's saying that this stress towards the super conscience is one way of thinking about the Brahman. It is another kind of exclusive thinking. It's another kind of intensive thinking. But at the same time, if we look at it not from that relative view of an exclusive or intensive property of consciousness, but look at it from the viewpoint of the integral being, then this property of consciousness must coexist with its opposite, that is, with the inclusive and comprehensive stress of consciousness. And so we realize that supreme being and its own supreme knowledge of itself is something which is simultaneously that of its own unmanifest, eternal, infinite potentiality, self-evident to itself as being, and its projection or objectification as cosmos, as universe. Universe with its two polarities of knowledge and ignorance, that which is representing pure infinite consciousness as being, and that which is representing that same pure infinite consciousness as becoming. A becoming which will constantly draw on being to manifest infinite powers and potentialities of the unmanifest. And at the same time, the becomings or the individual becomings of infinite individual powers and properties of the Infinite One, each becoming a certain face and form of this reality of knowledge. So one may say that individual becoming, such as what each of us could call ourselves, is infinite individual ways by which the self-knowledge of eternal being becomes manifest to itself, becomes known to itself, knowledge as manifestation. So that in an essence is what these two paragraphs are drawing on. And Sri Aurobindo is making clear that this integral view is what the Upanishads affirm. And he is talking about the Isha Upanishad there. And he uses a very interesting phrase or term, experience concept. Experience concept, he uses that term, he coins that term, because he's trying to draw the distinction between a certain kind of speculative philosophy, to use the term concept, idea, is to think about these profound realities in terms of possibilities, speculative thought. But he uses the term experience concept to draw this entire discussion into the domain of what is called darshan philosophy in India. In other words, all this that is being discussed is rooted in experience. These ideas are ideas that are experienceable and that correspond to realities of experience. Ultimately, not even just human experience, but experience of consciousness. So that is how Sri Aurobindo develops this idea of the integral reality and the integral knowledge as resting in both being and becoming, and as something which ultimately is necessary to build the foundation of the life divine, as he says. Because if these two are not related together, it becomes impossible to manifest or to give value to either the universe or the individual. Are there any comments, questions, etc.?
Devasuta, this is Shyam here.
Yes, hello, Shyam.
Yeah, I have a question. Devasuta?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what I like to know is, in the scheme of in the Life Divine, when he speaks about reality and the destiny of the individual, and in this kind of metaphysics, so where does the mother's role come in this metaphysics? Like, what is the role that she plays? Is it more of representing supernature, or is it more from a practical perspective that the role of the mother comes?
Okay, can you hear me? Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, there is a little echo. Now the echo has gone, so that's good. Your question is, what is the role of the mother in this metaphysics?
Yeah.
Well. You see, here Sri Aurobindo doesn't use the word mother, but mother is Shakti. So, you see, the becoming is taking place because there is a certain kind of self-knowing of Supreme Being that is occurring. And in self-knowing, if there is to be any kind of self-knowledge, whether at our limited individual levels or at the levels of Supreme Being, there must arise the question, who am I? So if such a question arises, we realize that within being itself there is a duality. To awaken a question, there must be a questioner and that which is questioned. One may say that it is self-knowledge, but within that self-knowledge, there is a knower and an object of knowledge that develops. So now this so-called duality can also be seen as a two-in-one. One which draws out from the other its own infinite potentialities. This two-in-one may also be seen or understood as a supreme kind of relationship, a kind of calling into becoming by the Shakti, by the consciousness force, of that which is latent in infinite being. One may say it is a play of Sat and Chit, a play initiated by Ananda. And that play is actually mobilized or given its particular sequential form by supermind. So the Shakti of the Supreme is central to the process of the self-knowledge of the Supreme. That is what we call the mother. So metaphysically speaking, the mother lies at the fount of bringing latency of being into becoming. And therefore, even in a practical sense, when we talk about the becoming, within the becoming, there are infinite individual becomings. As I was saying, each of us is a certain self-becoming of Brahman. And so each one of these self-becomings is actually being brought into reality, given its form, given its unfoldment, its evolutionary pattern, by the Shakti, that or who is integrally organizing the integral reality and integrally evolving the integral reality. This is the mother's practical role in our lives.
I have a question. Would it be fair to say that the absolute, the divine absolute, even though it has all knowledge of all potential, that when we come to the domain of manifestation, that it can only know that in the manifestation itself? It may know it in potential, but to know it in manifestation, that actually requires the creation of an evolutionary cosmos like ours, and that the divine doesn't actually know, although it knows in potential, it doesn't know in fact what the future holds of this manifestation, that is something which is being discovered simultaneously by both us in our aspect of the divine and by the divine absolute. I'm sorry, I'm not clear about that. It's a little hard to articulate.
Yeah, no, I get it. You want to expand it a little more?
No, that if you understand what I've, then go for it, please. Thank you.
Yes, Ron, you're right in the sense that the absolute is a kind of self-knowledge which is self-evident, as he says over there. So the self-evident self-knowledge can be compared in a kind of a relative way to our own self-evident self-knowledge when we are born as children. For example, you know, psychologists talk about a stage when we become sort of aware of ourselves as beings. See, this self-awareness or self-knowledge is a kind of objectification of self. Objectification of self takes place when we start recognizing that we not only are, but we are something. And not only are we something, but we are something with some things inside that something. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yes. So, for example, they talk about the mirror stage, when a child starts identifying parts of his or her body. They'll kind of lift a hand and just keep looking at the hand for a long time, twirling it round and around. Because the word hand has become a reality. It has become objectified. It is recognized as a part of the being, but also as being as that part. So in a similar way, we may say that the absolute knows itself absolutely in a self-evident knowledge, but the awakening of self-knowledge as a kind of objectification of self means the manifestation. And that implies a duality within that being. And that duality is a calling forth out of itself, its own contents. It's that mirror stage for Supreme Being. And we are part of that process of actually calling forth from itself its own knowledge. That's why we are, each one of us, one of the processes and beings of the self-knowledge of Supreme Being. In that way, you're absolutely right that Supreme Being gets to know itself through its own objectification as the creation, and through the creation's objectification, or through the creation's self-knowledge within this objectification.
Thank you. That, if I may just say a little bit more about that. That somehow makes me feel a little bit more comfortable about all of this, because the idea that somehow the absolute are already had a complete in detailed knowledge of how the future of manifestation of the cosmos from that scale down to our own individual lives would turn out, that it's already written, has this kind of, for me, uncomfortable feeling of predestined determinism. And I'm somehow relieved to, I think what you said is that that's not so, that manifestation, even for the divine, is something which is unknown what the future holds to anything or anyone, including the divine absolute. Am I saying that accurately? Is that a fair statement?
Ron, what you're saying is a very old debate and difficulty, which is the sort of duality between freedom and determinism. And the fact is that this duality itself is born out of our own limited understanding and out of our own finite reality. If we think for a moment of the infinite, then we can reformulate this divide and say that to any sense of freedom, there is always a greater determinism. And to any sense of determinism, there will always be a greater freedom. This gives us a certain sense of the infinite sort of range of reality and gives us a certain, you know, finite understanding of what it means to be infinite in terms of determinism and freedom. So we may say that in the supreme consciousness, there is absolute freedom and absolute determinism that coexist.
I have a question.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. That I was actually about to ask, and then probably this already is leading to certain kind of answer. That, you know, Mother talks about progressing from knowledge to knowledge.
Yes.
And would you translate, like, or just now you said there is for every, you know, freedom, there is a greater determinism, and for every determinism, there is a greater freedom.
Right.
So is it from knowledge to knowledge to knowledge, would it mean a quantum leap or something from one level of freedom to the next level of freedom by crossing the level of, rather the opposite, one level of determinism to another level of determinism by crossing through the level of freedom in between?
Yes, indeed. One may say that, and that's why this particular chapter itself begins with this notion of the mystery of the absolute. As you see that quotation from the Gita with which Sri Aurobindo begins this chapter, "Hear how thou shalt know me in my totality, for even of the seekers who have achieved, hardly one knows me in all the truth of my being." And now even in this, we are reminded the other quote from the Gita, which Sri Krishna is saying that some see me as wonderful, some hear of me as wonderful, some think of me as wonderful, but not one really knows who I am. And this is exactly what this idea of self-knowledge is. When he says not one knows really who I am, he's pointing to the infinite content and the fact that supreme being...
Excuse me, it's Debashish, excuse me for a minute. Keika, could you just mute your microphone, please, because we can hear you breathing very loudly, and it's hard to hear Debashish. Thank you.
Okay, so yes, the reality is representing itself to itself, and in that process, there is a degree, you know, one might, what I called somewhat a little bit earlier, the darkness of God. That is, God is unknown to himself in that sense. And in that, the objectification of that as matter, we see how the process of infinite evolution is set up. So you're absolutely right in that these are quantum leaps. Quantum leaps from states of determinism to greater states of determinism, which are at the same time greater states of freedom.
Can I ask another question?
Yes.
Yes.
On a related note, Debashish, is about knowledge and determinism. Similarly, objectification and objective. And subjectivity, is there an inherent truth to it in the divine scheme, or is it a human understanding of something else?
Yes, again, you know, that's the same thing. Objectivity and subjectivity, they are part of the human reality, but there is a certain truth to it in the divine as well, a truth which transcends but includes these two. That's why when we talk of an intrinsic duality within Supreme Being, we are saying that there is an objectivity and a subjectivity that coexist within it. And that's why it's a mystery. It remains a mystery because to us, these are two dualities. They're two polarities. They're separate, though inseparable. At the same time, in divine reality, they coexist and are integral to its reality. That's why, from a certain point of view, we may say that, you know, Sri Aurobindo uses the term the two in one. And in Vaishnava philosophy, you have the name given by Sri Chaitanya to his philosophy, which is Achintya Bheda Bheda, which literally means difference and non-difference, which are beyond, which coexist and at the same time are beyond thought, because these are, you know, the first rule of logic is A and not A cannot coexist, but they can in divine reality, because that is a infinite being. Infinity has its own mathematics and its own logic, we may say, and this is part of it. Objectivity and subjectivity coexist and are transcended at the same time within Supreme Being. That's what Sri Aurobindo says in that last paragraph that was read. I read that part. The liberated spirit sees all these as becomings of the self-existent in an internal vision and by a consciousness which perceives the universe within itself instead of looking out on it like the limited and egoistic mind as a thing other than itself.
Thank you.
So it is its own subject and it is its own object. And that can happen in a real sense because it is infinite to itself. That which is finite can know itself and know its own borders, its own limits. But that which is infinite to it, its own limits are always mysterious.
Hello.
Yes.
Is it a fair statement that to say that, you know, this subject and object is the basis of manifestation?
Yes. Yes. This is the duality which is the basis of manifestation, because this is one way of looking at self-knowledge of infinite being as a objectification of self to itself as the subject. And so without that, there can be no becoming. That is the essence of the fountainhead of becoming. That's why, as we said, and as Shyam's question was addressed, this duality is what we understand as the Lord and the Mother. As the mother says, without him I exist not, without me he is unmanifest.
This is great. I want to say, somehow I'm having the feeling that these basic issues, which I've been confused about for years, are somehow making a certain, they don't make sense, of course, but they're coming together now. It's really, this is the fundamental thing, isn't it? It's repeated in so many ways, like what you just said, Debashish, about this mother's statement about without him I would not exist, without me he would not be manifest, is really summarizing it also. It's this mystery of how we consider them incommensurate dualities in our human consciousness because of that A and not A logic, which is actually that logic proceeds from that kind of human way of thinking, I think. But there, it is possible to get a sense of another kind of simultaneity of both sides of the duality from the point of view of the divine.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Shall we read on, Sitaram? Sorry.
Sure. This is the paragraph that begins on the one side, right?
Yes.
Okay. On the one side, then, presented to us as the reality, we have an absolute self-existence, an eternal soul self-being. And through the experience of the silent and inactive self, or the detached, immobile Purusha, we can move toward this featureless and relationless absolute, negate the actions of the creative power, whether that be an illusory Maya or a formative Prakriti, pass from all circling in cosmic error into the eternal peace and silence, get rid of our personal existence, and find or lose ourselves in that sole true existence. On the other side, we have a becoming, which is a true movement of being, and both the being and the becoming are truths of one absolute reality. The first view is founded on the metaphysical conception, which formulates an extreme perception in our thought, an exclusive experience in our consciousness of the Absolute as a reality void of all relations and determinations, that imposes as its consequence a logical and practical necessity to deny the world of relativities as a falsity of unreal being, a non-existence, a non-existent asat, or at least a lower and evanescent temporal and pragmatic self-experience, and to cut it away from the consciousness in order to arrive at liberation of the spirit from its false perceptions or its inferior creations. The second view is based on the conception of the Absolute as neither positively nor negatively limitable. It is beyond all relations in the sense that it is not bound by any relativities or limitable by them in its power of being. It cannot be tied down and circumscribed by our relative conceptions, highest or lowest, positive or negative. It is bound neither by our knowledge nor by our ignorance, neither by our concept of existence nor by our concept of non-existence. But neither can it be limited by any incapacity to contain, sustain, create, or manifest relations. On the contrary, the power to manifest itself in infinity of unity and infinity of multiplicity can be regarded as an inherent force, sign, result of its very absoluteness, and this possibility is in itself a sufficient explanation of cosmic existence. The absolute cannot indeed be bound in its nature to manifest a cosmos of relations, but neither can it be bound not to manifest any cosmos. It is not itself a sheer emptiness, for a vacant absolute is no absolute. Our conception of a void or zero is only a conceptual sign of our mental inability to know or grasp it. It bears in itself some ineffable essentiality of all that is and all that can be. And since it holds in itself this essentiality and this possibility, it must also hold in itself in some way of its absoluteness, either the permanent truth or the inherent, even if latent, realizable actuality of all that is fundamental to our or the world's existence. It is this realizable actuality actualized, or this permanent truth deploying its possibilities, that we call manifestation and see as the universe. My God, I must say that his ability to string together words is it's just mind-boggling that could write like that. Sorry. Thank you. That's it.
Yes, I think maybe we can read another one. This entire paragraph really builds on what we have already discussed, and you know, there's a place where Sri Aurobindo says it in one of his very succinct and you know mantric sort of phrases or sentences. He says that the infinite is not bound by his freedom. See. And that is what he's saying over here. In other words, that to think that logically, because infinite reality is free, that it must be free of all world relations or world existence is also a bondage upon the illimitable freedom of infinity. And so if it isn't bound by its freedom, it is free to be bound. And that is exactly what he's saying over here. The absolute cannot indeed be bound in its nature to manifest a cosmos of relations, but neither can it be bound not to manifest any cosmos. That is its sheer freedom, its illimitable freedom. And the fact that it has the power to manifest itself infinitely and eternally as a creation that is constantly exploring more and more of itself is its own power. So manifestation really, from a certain point of view, is a play of power, is a exploration of the power of Supreme Being. And that's why consciousness is really a consciousness force.
Hello. Just one thing. I remembered there was one line in The Delight of Existence, The Problem, a chapter towards the beginning
yes.
of Life Divine.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I just wanted to read just one sentence.
Sure.
He says, if then being free to move or remain eternally still, to throw itself into forms or retain the potentiality of form in itself, it indulges its power of movement and formation. It can be only for one reason, for delight.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the reason why this is the standpoint that Sri Aurobindo takes, and this is the standpoint that the Upanishads take, that the only reason for creation is delight. That it's a causeless delight, which is at the cause of this manifestation.
You know, that word delight, it's really not the same, in the same way that we have to be careful about not projecting our human understandings upon the infinite.
Yes.
In the same way, that word delight, of course, shows up to us in terms of human relationships to happiness and so forth. And I assume that it's also true with that word, that that's simply a pointer, an English word, the best word that we can find, that points at something that is, in some sense, we can have a sense of it, but that the infinite in itself, doing these things out of delight, means something beyond our normal associations with that term. Is that fair?
Yes, yes, no doubt. Yes, Sita.
Yes, I think that's true in an absolute sense, what you're saying, Sitaram, although I think that I would also say, kind of complementary to what you said and not arguing with it, is that it's not that any words could be used interchangeably. I think someone like Sri Aurobindo, what's wonderful about his precise an inspired use of terms is that they give, from a sense, they're pointers towards some resonance that I think that we have, because we have the psychic center with the divine. It's not the same as, of course, but there's a resonance, and the different words do point to different resonances. That's my point. But I see what you're saying too.
So, actually, to talk about delight at the center of this entire manifestation of this becoming, which is something that in this particular chapter he has not introduced, but he talks about in other chapters, and maybe he will talk about it later in this set of chapters as well, is because there is a certain kind of question regarding what is the reason, what is the cause of this self-manifestation. Why did the divine choose to manifest itself or himself or herself? Why did this duality arise in the divine? And there may be a variety of answers given, but the highest answer given is that this is really a causeless creation, a creation without cause, because the divine is not bound by any necessity. There is no need to create. And that's exactly why this whole problem of why should there be a creation, and so maybe the creation is really a kind of a dream, a falsity, and let's get out of it. But nevertheless, there is another way of looking at it, and that is that it is a deliberate creation of the divine. And as a deliberate creation of the divine, there has to be some kind of will behind it. What is motivating that will? And that's the reason why the answer comes, that there is a will, but it's a causeless delight. Now, to understand that causeless delight from our human level, there may be two kinds of experiences that we can draw upon, that we can sort of tune into. And one is the creative process, because this is a creative process. The divine creates. And what we are reading right now about reality and the integral knowledge, if we translate it in terms of delight, we could say that the asking of a question, who am I, the objectification of the self, the arrival at self-knowledge is a creative process of self-knowledge. See, it's a creative process of the delight of knowledge. So one may say even in philosophy, there is a very intense delight, just as that kind of delight expresses itself through our existential need to know ourselves. So too, in the divine reality, there is a delight of self-knowledge, which is at the fount of the objectification of being. So that is one way by which we can think about this delight. The other human way we can think about this delight is what the mother says about the manifestation and its own sense of delight. She says that the greatest delight that a human being may have is the delight of arriving at new knowledge, arriving at a true sense of growth. When we suddenly wake up to something new, a new potentiality of being and of experience, there is a tremendous delight because our horizons have widened. Our knowledge of the limits of existence of the universe have suddenly expanded. That is the greatest delight. And so from that point of view, we can catch a glimpse of the delight of infinite being that becomes its own manifestation in the becoming. Shall we move on? I'm wondering.
Yes. Are you talking?
Hello. Hi. Ooh. Yeah. I don't know. I'm on the website page. What? Where are you? I just kind of joined in. So where are you exactly? Page what? Okay. Okay, page 638. I've got to go down a bit. Sorry. I was trying to catch up, but I didn't know where you guys were. Yeah, I can't find page 666. Is it on the next one? Is it not on the reality thing? Reality and integral knowledge, is it that one? Really? I don't see a 666.
Yes.
Actually, this is page 638, Jyoti.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Okay, hold on. Yeah, I'll be able to get there in a second then. Sorry guys, I'm still clicking away trying to find the page. Somebody else can do it it's taking my computer a while to get there.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. There is then, in the conception or the realization of the truth of the Absolute, no inherent inevitable consequence of a rejection or a dissolution of the truth of the universe. The idea of an essentially unreal universe manifested somehow by an inexplicable power of illusion, the Absolute Brahman regarding it not or aloof and not affecting it, even as it is unaffected by it, is at bottom a carrying over, an imposing or imputation, a dharopa of an incapacity of our mental consciousness to that, so as to limit it. Our mental consciousness, when it passes beyond its limits, loses its own way and means of knowledge and tends towards inactivity or cessation. It loses at the same time or tends to have no further hold on its former contents, no continuing conception of the reality of that which once was to it all that was real. We impute to absolute Parabrahman, conceived as non-manifest forever, a corresponding inability or separation or aloofness from what has become or seems now to us unreal. It must, like our mind in its cessation or self-extinction, be by its very nature of pure absoluteness, void of all connection with this world of apparent manifestation, incapable of any supporting cognition or dynamic maintenance of it that gives it a reality. Or, if there is such a cognition, it must be of the nature of an is that is not, a magical maya. But there is no binding reason to suppose that this chasm must exist. What our relative human consciousness is or is not capable of is no test or standard of an absolute capacity. Its conceptions cannot be applied to an absolute self-awareness. What is necessary for our mental ignorance in order to escape from itself cannot be the necessity of the absolute, which has no need of self-escape and no reason for refusing to cognize whatever is to it cognizable. Should I continue or should I stop?
I think maybe continue one more paragraph. It looks like
yes.
It's relevant.
Yes, sorry, I had my mic muted, but I also feel that read another, the next small paragraph.
Okay. There is that unmanifest, unknowable. There is this manifest, knowable, partly manifest to our ignorance, manifest entirely to the divine knowledge which holds it in its own infinity. If it is true that neither our ignorance nor our utmost and widest mental knowledge can give us a hold of the unknowable, still it is also true that whether through our knowledge or through our ignorance, that variously manifests itself, for it cannot be manifesting something other than itself, since nothing else can exist. In this variety of manifestation, there is that oneness, and through the diversity, we can touch the oneness. But even so, even accepting this coexistence, it is still possible to pass a final verdict and sentence of condemnation on the becoming and decide on the necessity of a renunciation of it and a return into the absolute being. This verdict can be based on the distinction between the real reality of the absolute and the partial and misleading reality of the relative universe.
You know, these paragraphs, they bring to light a tremendous problem in human conceptions and even experiences of the divine. And it also brings into our attention the whole field of the religious conceptions or spiritual conceptions of reality. In a sense, we have a certain need or a certain urge towards unity. And that urge is intrinsic to the mind. Mind particularly expresses that urge because it is conditioned by its own laws, the laws of mental nature, to arrive at something which is all-inclusive, which is something which unites all things. That's why the need for a unified field theory, for example. Logically, mind cannot rest with dualities unless it accepts that those dualities are the some kind of a sort of a partial approach towards something which is all uniting. And so, arising out of this need, our conceptions and experiences of the divine have tended towards a whole set of formulations which we might call monotheistic. Monotheistic religions affirm a single reality, the divine, as one, whether one person, one impersonal existence, one impersonal force or consciousness, whatever way or form, everything becomes subsumed into this one. And then there is a certain kind of secondary status or even false illusory status given to all other than the one. Everything must submit to that one. There is a dualism created, and in that dualism, the one is prioritized as the only good, the only experience worth having. Now, in contradistinction to this kind of conception and experience of the divine, there are also a number of conceptions or experiences that set up dualities but do not prioritize one over the others. One such conception is that of the tantras, in which we find the central image as that of Kali standing on the supine body of Shiva. Now, we might translate this as the same relationship that we were talking about earlier, as that between Sat and Chit, as being as and consciousness, conscious force. But as the tantrics put it, Shiva, who is the white cosmic existence, is just Shava, which means dead, the corpse. Unless it is or that is activated by Shakti. Shakti gives it, activates it. Now, in this image itself, there is a certain kind of duality But the duality is inseparable. It's the notion of an inseparable duality. The two coexist. However, there is not a one in which the two are both sort of united. It's not a two in one, but it's a two that cannot be torn apart. Similarly, there are other conceptions, spiritual conceptions. For example, in Sufism, there is one particular branch of Sufism that is called Naqshbandi. Naqshbandi means bandh. A bandh is like a knot. A naqsh is a design, naqsha. So it's like saying that the universe is like a knotted design, just like a knot, an inseparable knot. We try to cut it apart. And there is the old idea of the Gordian knot that Sri Aurobindo invokes sometimes, the Gordian knot that Alexander is supposed to have cut. But cutting the Gordian knot does not solve the problem, because the thing is, it's a knot because it contains inextricable dualities, dualities that cannot be cut. As soon as you cut them, you arrive at one which is prioritized over its opposite or its other. Now, at the human level, it is better to recognize that dualities are inseparable. Dualities coexist, that they are dialectically related, that they are constantly evolving due to this dialectical relationship. But also, one has to realize that beyond this dialectical relationship of dualities, there is a experience that transcends that particular formulation of the mind, which must have one or the other, in which A and not A can coexist and also be subsumed by something greater than it. And you can have the experience of all these as equally real. That's why when we talk about being as the infinite one, and really contemplate the two sides of this reality, to be one and to be infinite, to be fragmented into more and more particles and properties, and to be united as that which is indivisible, mind is something which cannot conceive of these as together. It can conceive of these in some sort of a relationship, but it can't conceive of these as the same thing, the two different things, radical unity and radical infinity. But Supreme Being is radically one and radically infinite at the same time. And that is the nature of experience or realization possible beyond the mind, in supermind. That's the reason why mind has this problem that Sri Aurobindo is talking about over here, a kind of a projection, an imputation, or adhyaropa, as he says, of an incapacity of our mental consciousness to that so as to limit it. We have to see it either this way or in that way, either as being or as becoming, either as sat or as chit, either as the one or as the many, either as eternity or as time. But as he puts it over here, if we realize that this is just a limitation of our existence as mental beings, then we do not need to limit Supreme Reality by that kind of law. And we aspire, then we can open our aspiration to that which is beyond the human, beyond post-human in that sense, beyond the mental and into the supramental. This is one of the problems of even spiritual experience in the past, that you know, there is a certain conception that all, you know, it comes from the Veda. The Veda says there is one truth, the seers speak of it differently. But this has been misinterpreted to mean that all the various religions are saying the same thing. they're not saying the same thing. They're prioritizing a certain one over the many others. And each one of these angles is actually a certain aspect of the supreme reality. And all of them can only coexist in a reality beyond the mind. And that's why an integral reality is the way in which the divine can know itself. But an exclusive reality is the only way that the mind can know the divine, even in terms of spiritual experience. In a sense, this is what Sri Aurobindo is constantly bringing to our notice, that we have in many, many ways tried to limit the supreme reality through projections of mental existence, mental conception. But supreme experience need not be the same as our highest mental experience of that existence. That's why there is a place where he says, I do not want to know the divine as humans know the divine, but as the divine knows himself.
I have a question, Debashish, though.
Yes.
Yes. Sure.
Can you spend a few minutes speaking about how Western philosophy has traditionally dealt with this problem of duality of an observer and what he's observing? And is it something that they've come to terms with, or is it something they're grappling with, or?
When you talk about Western philosophy, it's also a very, very large field. And one may say that Western philosophy has its own history and also its many sort of directions or its many branches. Many branches of Western philosophy do not deal with any kind of divine or absolute reality at all. They deal with what one might call social and political philosophies. But there are, of course, metaphysics, and there are various kinds of approaches to reality or existence as a whole. Now, only in recent times there has been a kind of an assessment of the whole history of Western philosophy, and it comes to us from a few very major thinkers of the 19th and 20th century, particularly of the turn of the century, one of them being the philosopher Heidegger. And Heidegger actually revisits this entire history of Western philosophy, and he divides it up maybe in a way not very different from the way Sri Aurobindo divides up Indian philosophy. And he divides it up in terms of what he calls pre-Socratic philosophy and post-Socratic philosophy. And in fact, you know, there are people, even philosophers today, who say that most of Western philosophy after Plato, for example, can be thought of as postscripts on Plato. In other words, they are regurgitating or revisiting the same ideas that Plato introduces. Of course, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle come in a certain lineage, okay, one after the other. The pre-Socratic philosophy in the West that comes out of Greek thinking, people like Heraclitus, interestingly, Sri Aurobindo himself has written a little pamphlet on Heraclitus. And the reason he's written it is for the very same reason that Heidegger is pointing to these pre-Socratic philosophers, as philosophers who, one may say, have a certain kind of intuitive grasp of reality that is more of this inseparable kind that we are talking about, more a kind which aims at the integrality, and therefore mysterious, therefore in a sense paradoxical. It's only from Socrates that the need for logic, and mainly even from Aristotle, as the foundation for philosophy comes up. And from that point on, what we are talking about, what I just said about the mind's inability and the mind's projection, becomes also the Western disease of philosophy. It feels that it has a right on proclaiming the nature of reality based on mental logical processes. And so, as you're saying over there, the same kind of problems are encountered by it. Only prior to that, we had a certain stream of thinking, which one might call sort of contemporary or in some sense similar to that of the Upanishads. And then we find a kind of thinking that becomes more and more mentalized and speculative and contentious. And it's only again now with a return to certain new forms of Western philosophy like phenomenology that an attempt is being made to return to that more integral and intuitive kind of thinking. See, a kind of self-questioning which becomes more and more identified with the self-questioning of being to itself. Now, I don't want to go into depths as far as that is concerned, but in a sense, it also points to Western philosophy's realization of its own limitations, and modern philosophers, like starting from people like Nietzsche down through Heidegger and people like Derrida, have been very active in trying to critique the problems of the mind or rationality in trying to grapple with reality.
Yeah, thank you, Debashish. I didn't mean to deviate off topic too much, but anyways, this is good information.
Debashish, I have a question.
Yes, yes.
This is that in the Life Divine so far, we are seeing that he is comparing mind and saying that mind is mostly an instrument of disharmony and supermind is the instrument of harmony. But to make this leap from mind to supermind, can we use the other levels like overmind and illumined mind as handholding steps? Or are they also considered part of mind and just a little less disharmonious than mind?
Yes. No, you're right in that sense that he is pointing to the problems of the mind and the limitations of the mind. And we may say that, I mean, we are talking about just one chapter here, but in other chapters he points out how the limitations of the mind begin from the overmind. But he's also saying that the overmind is an intermediate level between the becoming and the knowledge. In fact, between the knowledge and the ignorance, as he calls it. This chapter itself that we are reading is the first chapter of part two. But prior to that, he has other chapters in which he's talking about the boundaries of the ignorance, knowledge by identity and separative knowledge, etc. And in these chapters, he is actually pointing out that what he calls the overmind is at its heights almost inseparable from supermind. It is like a membrane. It is like an inside of the supermind, which at the same time is an outside. Okay, it's like something which is hardly alien to supermind. And so these intermediate ranges of being, of mind, going beyond the human mind, are ranges that one might say we travel in a reverse direction. Just as we may say that from overmind down to the material principle, there is a progressive, intensive focus, a focus which becomes more and more exclusive on individual multiplicities. So when we take the opposite route, we find that moving through the higher ranges of mind, we arrive at a more and more comprehensive kind of consciousness. And ultimately, overmind itself is seen as a kind of dual process both holding the infinite one and generating from it the infinite many. See, so this is taking a certain form in overmind. But the form that it takes in overmind is an exclusive form of this reality. In other words, overmind can focus on any one of these various kinds of divine realities as an exclusive reality. Overmind represents infinite being to itself in infinite ways. And each of these infinite ways is a reality to it, is a separate reality to it. This is the reason why mind's take on the Supreme Being has this kind of problem of many ones, each one pretending to be the only one. See, the ultimate problem for all the conflicts of the universe, as you say, the conflicts, all problems of reality or problems of harmony, arise because of this formative power of the overmind. But it is only a power of the overmind. The overmind itself in its consciousness can hold these powers together. And even more beyond it, when its own limits are crossed, we come to the supermind, and there we come to the principle which actually sees reality as its own self-manifestation. As the Veda puts it, where the sun unyokes its horses, all the rays of the sun return to its origin. But they don't lose themselves as individual rays. So that is the reality. From our point of view, it is necessary to go through the intermediate planes. But at the same time, it is also necessary to recognize that these intermediate planes are still not the final resting point. That our resting point is only through a progressive substitution, as we were discussing earlier, as Keka was saying, there is a progressive, greater and greater comprehensive determinism that leads to a progressive, greater and greater freedom, and ultimately takes us beyond the boundaries of the ignorance into the supreme knowledge.
Yeah, that is nice. Thank you.
Okay, or how about if somebody reads one paragraph as a introduction to what we are going to do next time, just as we did last time. Read one last paragraph and just bring it into our consciousness and then move on to the next week.
Ropa, would you like?
Yeah, Shyam will read.
For we have, in this unfolding of knowledge, the two terms of the one and the many, as we have the two terms of the finite and the infinite, of that which becomes and of that which does not become, but forever is, of that which takes form and of that which does not take form, of spirit and matter, of the supreme superconscient and the nethermost inconscience. In this dualism, and to get away from it, it is open to us to define knowledge as the possession of one term and the possession of the other as ignorance. The ultimate of our life would then be a drawing away from the lower reality of the becoming to the greater reality of the being. A leap from the ignorance to the knowledge and a rejection of the ignorance. A departure from the many into the one, from the finite into the infinite, from form into the formless, from the life of the material universe into the spirit, from the hold of the inconscient upon us into the superconscient existence. In this solution, there is supposed to be a fixed opposition, an ultimate irreconcilability in each case between the two terms of our being. Or else, if both are a means of the manifestation of the Brahman, the lower is a false or imperfect clue, a means that must fail, a system of values that cannot ultimately satisfy us. Dissatisfied with the confusions of the multiplicity, disdainful of even the highest light and power and joy that it can reveal, we must drive beyond to the absolute one-pointedness and one-standingness in which all self-variation ceases. Unable by the claim of the infinite upon us to dwell forever in the bonds of the finite, or to find there satisfaction and largeness and peace, we have to break all the bonds of individual and universal nature, destroy all values, symbols, images, self-definitions, limitations of the illimitable, and lose all littleness and division in the self that is forever satisfied with its own infinity. Disgusted with forms, disillusioned of their false and transient attractions, wearied and discouraged by their fleeting impermanence and vain round of recurrence, we must escape from the cycles of nature into the formlessness and featurelessness of permanent being. Ashamed of matter and its grossness, impatient of the purposeless stir and trouble of life, tired out by the goalless running of mind, or convinced of vanity of all its aims and objects, we have to release ourselves into the eternal repose and purity of the spirit. The inconscient is a sleep or a prison, the conscient a round of strivings without ultimate issue or the wanderings of a dream. We must wake into the superconscious, where all darkness of night and half-light cease in the self-luminous bliss of the eternal. The eternal is our refuge. All the rest are false values, the ignorance and its mazes, a self-bewilderment of the soul in phenomenal nature.
I would almost suggest reading one more paragraph, just because in the next paragraph, I think he balances a little bit of what he just said.
Do you want me to continue or? Shall I go on then?
Yes, please.
Our conception of the knowledge and the ignorance rejects this negation and the oppositions on which it is founded. It points to a larger, if more difficult, issue of reconciliation. For we see that these apparently opposite terms of one and many, form and the formless, finite and infinite, are not so much opposites as complements of each other, not alternating values of the Brahman, which in its creation perpetually loses oneness to find itself in multiplicity, and, unable to discover itself in multiplicity, loses it again to recover oneness. But double and concurrent values which explain each other, not hopelessly incompatible alternatives, but two faces of the one reality which can lead us to it by our realization of both together, and not only by testing it separately, even though such separate testing may be a legitimate or even an inevitable step or part of the process of knowledge. Knowledge is no doubt the knowledge of the one, the realization of the being. Ignorance is a self-oblivion of being, the experience of separateness in the multiplicity, and a dwelling or circling in the ill-understood maze of becomings. But this is cured by the soul in the becoming growing into knowledge, into awareness of the being which becomes in the multiplicity all these existences and can so become because their truth is already there in its timeless existence. The integral knowledge of Brahman is a consciousness in possession of both together, and the exclusive pursuit of either closes the vision to one side of the truth of the omnipresent reality. The possession of the being who is beyond all becomings brings to us freedom from the bonds of attachment and ignorance in the cosmic existence, and brings by that freedom a free possession of the becoming and of the cosmic existence. The knowledge of the becoming is a part of knowledge. It acts as an ignorance only because we dwell imprisoned in it. Avidyayam antare. Without possessing the oneness of the being, which is its base, its stuff, its spirit, its cause of manifestation, and without which it could not be possible.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very nice. And those two paragraphs were so wonderful. And really, they actually bring a much more natural close to the train of thoughts that we've been reading today.
Well, thank you very much, Debashish, and everyone else.
Yeah.